welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Michael Polignano. Today we'll continue with the second part of our interview with Seattle artist Charles Kraft.
I've been rereading Frederick Spotts' book. It's called Hitler and the Power of Aesthetics. It's one of my favorite books about Hitler and the Third Reich because it's one of the most fair-minded books I've ever read. One of the things that it underlines to me is the difference between art policy in Germany and art policy in fascist Italy, because one of the things that the Italians embraced was modernism. The futurists were a modernist art movement. There was a movement called Novecento that was a modernist art movement. And it's interesting because Hitler just didn't have any liking for anything modern, and a lot of his own inner circle had really strongly modernist tastes. People like Goebbels really liked Edvard Munch and Van Gogh, and they thought that the last thing that they needed for National Socialism, the thing that was furthest from the spirit of their age, was, say, 19th century minor German painters that Hitler liked, like Spitzweg. So there was this fascist, steely, romantic modernism that was sort of aborted in Germany, but still, it was very powerful in Italy. Do you like Italian futurism? Do you like Italian Art Deco? What do you think of all that?
Well, I like the vorticists. Wyndham Lewis, he's a guy that I sort of overlooked earlier on, but I'm revisiting him and realizing that he was better than I thought he was. Balla, I don't know much about Marinetti, what he painted, but I like those Italian futurist vortex paintings, you know, where everything is triangulated and put into these crazy perspectives, including that beautiful 360-degree futurist sculpture of Mussolini's head. Do you remember that thing? That it's a face, but it doesn't look anything like a face because it's spinning.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I know.
That I do like. I don't know too much about what was going on in Germany at the time. I can't rattle off the names of their painters. I like their design, the industrial design and the military design, but I can't say who was great in Germany, although von Stuck, would you consider him German, or where would you put von Stuck? Because I like him.
Well, von Stuck died in the 1920s. He was a Munich painter. He would fit in more with symbolism as a movement, in my opinion. I think he's one of the great 19th, early 20th century painters myself.
What about those two painters that the Frauen Museum in Seattle featured that were metaphysical?
You know, yeah, Gabriel von Max and Gottfried Keller.
Yeah, don't you love those paintings?
Those are fantastic. They were 19th century German, South German Munich academic painters.
They were
fantastic, yeah. They were on the highest level, I thought.
Gabriel von Max, what's his name?
Gabriel von Max, yeah.
Those monkey paintings, aren't those the most splendid things you've ever seen?
Oh, yeah.
Some of the most splendid stuff you've ever looked at? I mean, those monkey paintings just slay me.
Yeah, yeah. They were tremendous painters. And, of course, modernism has pretty much consigned all of these people to the footnotes now, especially in English-speaking countries, and it's an amazing resource, the Frye Museum, because they actually have it as their mission to provide a place where people can see this kind of work. So
yeah,
it's a great place.
Who's the playwright from Sweden that was also a painter and a photographer and a musician? I can't remember his name right now. Helium, and you know, there's that little thing on YouTube, Helium. I want to say Stendhal, but it's not.
Is it Strindberg?
Strindberg, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Strindberg. Hey, that guy was a great painter.
I've never seen his paintings.
Oh, you must. I'll show them to you the next time I see him. They're just great. They're landscapes, and they're full of Scandinavian storm clouds, among other things.
Well, I'll have to see that.
Yeah, no, I like Strindberg.
The people who order your artwork, where are they located? Across the world or locally?
I'm preparing low resolution photographs of my work for a book company in Berlin, Gestalt and Verlag. They're interested in putting out a book about it. And I'm going to be in another exhibition in Paris. It's sort of this lowbrow group in Paris want to do a show that's going to include me, and they're going to publish a catalog. And I have a Japanese collector. There's a guy in Japan that likes my early paintings. He doesn't like the blue and white Delft disasterware as much as he likes what I was doing when I was out living in the country painting landscapes, Zen style. So they're everywhere. They're in Seattle. They find me on the internet. I have a gallery in Australia, Seattle, San Francisco. No, I don't have one in New York. That's interesting. Los Angeles, Amsterdam, and in Italy and Rome. And Melbourne, Melbourne, Australia. So I'm feeding these are shops, actually. This is interesting. This lowbrow thing, of which I'm sort of a part, is being marketed in shops rather than in galleries or gallery shops. It goes both ways. So I don't know how quite to describe these places because I haven't visited a number of them, but it looks to me from the pictures I see that they have books. Have you ever been to that place called the Soap Plant in Los Angeles? It's called Wacko now.
No.
Oh, it's run by this guy, Billy Shire. It's got books, souvenirs, kitsch, interesting stuff picked up around the world and put on shelves for you to look at and buy. And then spaces for exhibitions, that are up for a month and then come down. So it's a melange of interesting objects that you can purchase when you walk into one of these places. Lots of limited editions.
Right. It's sort of a boutique / gallery kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good word. Thank you. A boutique gallery. Exactly.
Who are some of the famous people who have collected your works?
Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo owns something. Chris Stein of Blondie owns something. Grace Slick never bought anything from me, but I've given her some things, so let's put her on that list.
Okay. Any Hollywood people?
Yeah, there's some Hollywood people, but you know what? I forget who they are. I mean, I got to look at this list. I don't really keep up with it that much. I can't think of any actors, any celebrities. I guess I'm not collected by celebrities. I'm more collected by musicians and people in the music industry.
Well, that's really interesting in itself.
Let me think if there's an actor. I just can't pull one out of my hat right now. I'm sure there is one because this in Santa Monica, the Copronason Gallery handles my work, and I guess some actors have come in there and bought something, I've been told. But I can't remember who they told me it was, so I'm sorry.
Have you ever done any album art?
No. I'd like to do some if anybody wants to. I've seen, some of my stuff has been appropriated by people that do raves. Cards that have some of my grenades in blue and white on them that have been manipulated in such a way to make them look like, it's rave art.
Uh-huh.
I've seen that happen. These kids are mining the internet for imagery, and sometimes they happen onto my stuff, and it gets turned into advertising for clubs, events at clubs. I've seen that happen. But nobody's actually come to me and said, hey, we got a concept album we want you to help us illustrate. Nobody's ever done that.
I first encountered your work in a volume on pop surrealism, I believe.
That was the first coffee table ever written about this movement. And it was going to be called lowbrow art, but Mark Ryden didn't like the derogatoriness of that lowbrow name. So he insisted if he was going to be in the book that the author should call it pop surrealism. And it was published in Seattle, and it was written up by Kirsten Anderson. That was the first book about this movement, and there's been more since. I can't remember the names of the titles of the other books, but she put me in it because I'm a local guy, and she's got a gallery here, and she wanted to get involved in lowbrow art, and I was making it.
Well, yeah, so that's how I first got knew your name, and then I believe around 2006 I sold a Savitri Devi book to you, and that's how we first actually got in touch.
Oh, when you were down in Atlanta?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I bought a book from you, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was interested in Savitri Devi through my friend Adam Parfrey that runs Feral House Books. He introduced me to her. What's that one about the sun?
The lightning and the sun.
Yeah, I just thought that was wacky. you know, but Hitler is Akhenaten, right?
Well, Hitler is an avatar of Vishnu.
Oh, but where does Akhenaten the Pharaoh come in?
Well, Akhenaten sort of comes in as an exemplar of the man Vishnu. Above time as opposed to the man against time.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like the impractical spiritual teacher who's sort of ultimately ground down by the system, whereas Hitler had enough mastery of the world that he could actually fight and try and change society, resist the downward course of decadence, whereas Akhenaten just got steamrollered by it in the end.
And so Hitler was the avatar. What's this business about the Kalki avatar then? Isn't that supposed to come at the end of the Kali Yuga? Why are they calling Hitler the Kalki avatar?
Well, you see, that's a misnomer. She believed that Hitler wasn't the last avatar, but he was the penultimate avatar.
Oh, second to the last.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, some people, for instance, in Who's the Guy, David Tibet, wrote this song, Hitler is Kalki. Either he disagrees with that view or he just didn't understand what Savitri Devi was saying. And I guess Miguel Serrano describes Hitler as the last avatar.
Well, Adam Parfrey is an interesting guy, and he's had his thumb on all kinds of offbeat stuff, you know, for most of his career, which is about 25 years of publishing now. And he introduced me to Savitri Devi's Lightning Over the Sun, and then I would run into those copies of that book in used bookstores, and that's how I heard about her first, and I thought it was kind of a wacky idea about the Kalki avatar, not the about Hitler being an avatar or a pharaoh. You know, I can't remember exactly. You know more about it than me, so that's probably why I ordered the book from you.
Right.
But why don't we tell them about my big trip to Savitri Devi's friend in Aruna Chala, you know, that sent me packing when I found her.
Yeah. Well, I gave you the name and address of this woman who knew Savitri Devi, who lived in Tiruvannamalai. Her name, she's dead now. Her name was Miriam Hearn. And I wrote to her and said that you were going to be traveling there, and maybe she didn't get the... Maybe she didn't get the letter or something.
I wrote to her too, you know, once I was in India. I said, I'm on my way. I'd like to have, I was in Trivandrum and I wrote to her and I told her that I'd like to have a meeting with her. And I did get on a bus and I traveled all night, you know, to get to Trivannamalai. Is that the name of that place, the town where she was?
Tiruvannamalai. Yeah.
Tiruvannamalai. Thanks. I'm terrible. I mean, I've been there, but I can't pronounce it. She wouldn't see me. There was a man with her. They wouldn't open the door, and he shooed me away with his hands. And then he threw his hands in the air like, I can't help you. You know, she doesn't want to see you. So
she could be very exasperating. She had a certain paranoid streak to her that could be very exasperating. Mm-hmm. She died almost exactly 2 years ago. She died on April 16th, 2010, and I didn't discover it until March of this year.
Are they both Savitri Devi and she disciples of Ramana Maharshi?
Well, Savitri Devi never really followed Ramana Maharshi. She respected him tremendously and thought he was really a genuine holy man. But this woman, Miriam Hearn, was very much a follower of Ramana Maharshi. And she was a civil servant in the French embassy in New Delhi. And that's how they met, how Savitri Devi met Miriam Hearn, and they got to be good friends. This was in the 1970s. Even before they met, Miriam Hearn was traveling from Delhi to Tiruvannamalai to spend time at the Ramana Ashram. And after she retired from the civil service, she thought she'd go back to France, but then she quarreled with her relatives in France, and she just decided to go back to India. And so she lived in Tiruvannamalai on and off for the rest of her life. Primarily, she lived there, and she would go to the ashram every day.
Uh-huh.
When I visited her there in 2004, you know, we would go to the ashram, and And it was a genuinely spiritual place. It was really quite a beautiful place. One day we took a trip to Pondicherry, and we went to the Aurobindo ashram, and you couldn't imagine a greater contrast between the two institutions, because the Aurobindo ashram is just a giant gift shop and bookshop, and they're just hawking things. Every square inch of it is full of merchandise for you to buy. I think that probably has a lot to do with the fact that the mother of the ashram, Mira Alfasa, was a French Jewess, and she certainly applied her people's business acumen to running that ashram.
What was Aurobindo Alzheimer'd out at the end of his life? That's what I heard.
Yeah, I mean,
that she took over and sort of kept this secret that he had lost his faculties.
Right, that's entirely possible. Miguel Serrano has an absolutely wicked description of the Aurobindo ashram in his book on the serpent. And Savitri Devi, in her last book, The Memories and Reflections of an Aryan Woman, she describes the contrast between those two ashrams pretty much in the same. I mean, I'm borrowing her language, but it fit perfectly when I got there just to see the difference. I guess the Aurobindo ashram is basically the biggest landlord in Pondicherry. They own like a third of the town now. They get buying things up.
Yeah.
Probably loaned money out and then foreclosed.
I went to Pondicherry. I was impressed with its cleanliness, and I bought a croissant there. You know, it's very French. Didn't go to the ashram though. I didn't make it there.
Well, they probably owned the place that sold you the croissant. But it's so funny. I knew I was in Pondicherry because suddenly we had gone from twisting, chaotic Indian streets to suddenly a Cartesian grid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I know. It felt like home, didn't it?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, exactly.
So I bought a really nice little statue of Gandhi from the hotelier that put me up. I saw this thing in his foyer, and I asked him if I could buy it from him, and he said, sure. So it's my only souvenir from that trip.
Mm-hmm. I got this beautiful statue of Vishnu and his avatars when I was in India in 2004, and I went to various really nice shops where they sold, you know, sandalwood carvings and things like that, which they assured me were all from trees that were cut down before they were banned. Of course, they were probably lying. But anyway, I went there, and I kept asking for an image of the Kalki avatar, and nobody had any images of Kalki. And finally, I asked this old Brahmin gentleman why they didn't have any images of Kalki. And his response to me was so charming. He said, "The Kalki avatar has not come yet." How can we have an image of him if he hasn't come yet? As if all these other images were, you know, from life, right?
Right, exactly. Did you happen to get into any Nicholas Roerich? Did you ever look into his life?
He's a really interesting character. I've seen his paintings and I've done a little reading, but I don't know all that much about him.
I don't either. I went to his center in New York City and looked at his paintings and his son's paintings. Apparently he worked for the Ballet Russe, you know, as a set painter.
Right. And didn't he paint the sets for The Rite of Spring?
Uh-huh.
Premiere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he moved to India and he was living in the foothills of the Himalayas for years. And who was that musician that wrote that, The Labyrinth? Remember? He was a French musician, and he wrote a book about India, and he went to visit Nicholas Roerich.
Oh, yes, that's Alain Danielu.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was a good book.
That is a great book. I really like that book tremendously.
Yeah, I do too. I recommend that book for anybody that's thinking about visiting India, or anybody with nostalgia for the India, you know, of the last century, the end of the tail end of the 20th century.
I really liked your forgiveness line of cosmetics.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder how that went over, if you got a lot of flack from that, and also how well they sold and if you are still making them.
I haven't gotten really any flack over them. Periodically, I do a little installation where I've got the soap and the perfume and the advertising that goes with it on display. It continues to pique people's curiosity. It's not a big seller because of the swastika, of course. Nobody wants swastikas in their homes because it reflects on them, they think, and or they think their neighbors and friends will misconstrue the symbol and accuse them of something. So no, I can't say it's a big deal for me, but I continue to have people buy it from me every once in a while. You know, I'll sell them a bottle of forgiveness. I had it, you know, I had a custom scent made by a essential oils salesman in Los Angeles, and I told him I wanted the scent to be blood on snow. And he said, well, that's a challenge. And so he sent me back a variety of scents that he'd come up with, and I chose one. And there really is a forgiveness scent. But I'll tell you what, I've never smelled blood on snow, and this isn't it for sure. But it's a nice smell. It's got vetiver in it, lots of vetiver. The soap is really porcelain, the bar of soap. I've made bars of real glycerin soap, but it's too much trouble for me to go and make a bar. I mean, it's just as easy for me to make a bar of porcelain soap as a bar of real soap. And I can, I mean, this is terrible, but I can ask more money for porcelain than real.
Right.
So I stick to the porcelain. You've got to buy this fake soap from me if you want a bar of forgiveness.
If you want a bar of forgiveness. Yeah.
What inspired that idea?
Oh, well, I was in Sarajevo one night with Peter Malakar, who's the official orator of the Laibach band, and he's also the head of their department of pure and applied philosophy, NSK. And he was just drunk as a lord. We'd been to a club, and we were going home to where we were being put up, and it was up this steep hill above the bombed out Winter Olympic Stadium, you know, just torched. And then next to that was a maternity hospital, and that had been torched. And so we were overlooking the ruins of these two facilities from the top of a hill in the full moonlight in the snow. If you can imagine, the cab couldn't get up the hill because the road was all icy. So he let us out, and we were walking up to where we were staying. And he turned around and looked at this devastation all around us and said, "Ah, the smell of blood on snow. It's so Tolstoy. I love it. If I could create a scent for the 21st century, I would call it forgiveness." And I remember that. And when I got back, I went to work on creating a line of cosmetics that were sort of based on that offhanded remark that was full of irony, you know, that he made the night that we were in Sarajevo. I think I got that quote right. I might have had it wrong. But essentially, he was just saying that the devastation required a new perfume, and it should be called forgiveness.
So I love your snuggle bunnies and your various rabbit-themed
pieces. Right. Frank Kozik is a San Francisco lowbrow artist who started out as a poster maker for rock and roll concerts, and has, you know, graduated to toys now. He puts out a lot of plastic toys that are made in Japan for him and China. And he did this thing called a dunny, a smoking bunny, that's kind of pneumatic looking. It has no features except a cigarette stuck in its mouth, two ears, and this crazy body that doesn't have any detail. Looks like a blimp. He was coming to town for an exhibition at the Rock LaRue Gallery, and Kirsten Anderson, the director there, wanted to put us together. And I thought that was a good idea because Frank had used a lot of Nazi imagery in his rock posters, these Day Glow rock posters, which came after the psychedelic rock posters from the Haight-Ashbury. They were just as great, you know, and a completely different sensibility, but just as graphically wonderful. So I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to show with Kozik. So he came to town, and he had a book, and he was flogging that, and he had 100 little robot Hitlers that he'd made that out of plastic. He had some company in Japan do them for him, and they were lined up 10 deep on a wall, you know, 10 high and 10 deep. And his rabbit, this dunny, and these kids were bringing these toys that they had got from a shop in New York that sells artist toys called Kid Robot. They had manufactured the smoking bunny. I call it a dunny, but that's not right. It's a smorkin. He calls this thing a smorkin. They wanted Frank to autograph it. And so I knew he was coming, and I wanted to do a smoking bunny myself. I had a bunny mold that I'd found, you know, in an abandoned ceramic hobby shop, and I just stuck a cigarette in it. It's an homage to Frank Kozik. And I, for some reason, this damn thing is just, like, taken off. I mean, I, the two things that I sell the most of are hand grenades and smoking bunnies.
And I've seen the combo of the bunny grenade combos.
Yeah, I put a grenade in the bunny's hands, and sometimes the bunny has a hypodermic needle. That's the junkie bunny. And sometimes it's just sitting there smoking on its haunches, and people just seem to like it. So they, I've sold, you know, not a whole lot of bunnies, but enough to make it, enough for me to be able to call it one of the more popular items that, you know, I've come up with. I stole the thing from Frank Kozik. I'm sorry to say, it's not me. It's Frank.
Well, it's an homage, not a theft.
Yeah, right. It was an homage. Thanks a lot for asking me to participate, because I like the Countercurrents website. I'm honored to, you know, be affiliated with it.
Great. Well, thank you.
I like your books, too. I just read Revolution from Above, you know.
Oh, that's from Arctos.
Yeah. Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry. But then Erman Vincent, Some Thoughts About Hitler.
Yeah.
I read that. I thought that was great. And Kerry Bolton, I told you, I think he's really good.
I think he's really good. And we're bringing out a book of his very soon, The Artists of the Right. So yeah. I'm working on that as we speak practically. So.
Oh, good. Because I think that he's one of the best explicators of the political direction that I find myself in living today. I mean, if I could try to explain how I think and why I'm thinking the way I am, I would direct people to Kerry Bolton, because he's done a really good job of explaining things, I think.
I agree.
I consider him a guru. You know, I told you this. I think he's...
Yeah.
He was... I got in touch with him when, you know, he was writing about the Order of the Nine Angles of all things. I was investigating Satanism, and he had the. You know, have you ever heard of the Order of the Nine Angles?
Yeah. I don't know much about it, but
well, they were supposed to carry out these cullings, where they would grab people and sacrifice them. It's kind of a urban myth, but these guys were supposed to be the baddest of the bad black magicians, you know, practicing sorcery today. And I wrote to Kerry Bolton because he had some information that he was selling about him. And then I started ordering some of his other stuff, and I'm happy to see him getting involved with getting more exposure over the internet, because tracking him down was something, you know, a bit of a task in the old days before the internet.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
You know, he was there in New Zealand on that beach, and you send him the money, and then you get this stuff from him, and it was always interesting.
Yeah.
And I just love going to Foreign Affairs, that thing, that the blog he writes for. What's the name of that one where he's commenting on geopolitical stuff as it happens?
Yeah, the Foreign Affairs Journal or something.
Yeah, Foreign Affairs Journal.
Yeah.
I go there to see what he's put up regularly. And every time he puts something up, I'm usually impressed with it.
Yeah, I agree. He's done a lot of great things for us about the color-coded revolutions around the world. Twitter and Facebook insurrections in the Near East and so forth. So.
Yeah. All of that stuff, people should be reading him instead of Noam Chomsky, for God's sakes.
Yeah, he's our Noam Chomsky.
I know. Yeah, we should bring him to the United States and have some Kerry Bolton events, I think.
We'll definitely talk about doing that. It's a bit expensive to get somebody from New Zealand, but...
Has he spoken at any conferences overseas?
That I don't know, you know. I don't know too much about the man.
Yeah, I don't know either. If he hasn't, it would be great to be the first people to roll him out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, listen, get in touch with me if you want some financial assistance, and if I've got some extra money, I'll put it into bringing him here.
Well, that's fantastic. We'll definitely.
I really would like to meet him.
We'll take you up on that. We really will.
Okay, let's get a, yeah, let's pass the hat and get him here.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, Charlie, this has been a really enjoyable conversation. Is there anything you want to say just at the end? Is there, are there any questions that we should have asked you that you would like to answer before we go?
I don't think so, other than I wish I had more of a vision, you know, for artists in your movement. I don't really know what we can do except just get more people exposed to the work that we like. And maybe that'll lead to, you know, a some kind of transmogrification from then to now. And we'll get some of the craftsmanship and ideas that we like so much back into contemporary art. You know, artists don't learn from nature so much as from each other. So the trick is to get people that are involved in art and want to be artists and appreciating art to broaden their horizons by introducing the names and works of these people that are overlooked by history.
Well, I think we've made a good start with that in this very conversation. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks, Troy.
You're welcome, Michael.
We've got some really good material here, and Mike will do a transcription of it too, so you can read the transcript.
Oh, I could put it in my resume and get fired?
Yeah, exactly.
I could fire myself because I'm self-employed?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.